So we've been moving through Mark. Today we're going to look at the fifth chapter. It's a rather famous story amongst preachers. Stephanie preached about this one several months ago, a wonderful sermon. And if you were here to hear that one, you'll just see this one's very different, how you can take the same text and pull different threads and get different meanings out of the same text. When Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, A great crowd gathered around him, and he was by the sea. Then one of the leaders of the synagogue named Jairus. Notice that we have a name here. It's a leader of the synagogue named Jairus. And when he saw him, he fell at his feet and begged him repeatedly. This is Jairus begging Jesus. My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live. So Jesus went with him. And a large crowd followed him and pressed in on him. If you can visualize this crowd, Jesus has people, right? He's got the disciples. And Jairus, who was an important man, he had people. So it's a lot of people on this important mission to save the life of this little girl. Now, there was a woman who had been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years. She had endured much under many physicians and had spent all that she had. And she was still no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard about Jesus, and she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak. For she said, if I but touch his clothes, I will be made well. Immediately her hemorrhage stopped, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And immediately, aware that power had gone forth from him, Jesus turned about in the crowd and said, who touched my clothes? And his disciples said to him, you can see they're incredulous. They say, you see the crowd pressing in on you? How can you say, who touched me? He looked all around to see who had done it. And the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. He said to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Imagine, if you will, that you have been summoned. This has happened to some of you. You've been summoned by somebody really important, an important mission. Maybe you work for General Motors and you're summoned by the CEO, Mary Barra, or by Tim Cook at Apple. Maybe you can think of whoever your boss is, wherever you work, and you get a note from them. They say, look, I need you in my office right away. This is important. Maybe you're an active citizen here in the city of Plano, on the city council or the commissioner's court or on a commission of some kind. And suddenly you are summoned to Austin by the governor. You don't know what it's all about, but you know this is important. You get up and you go, right? If you're a preacher, it's the bishop. The bishop calls me and says, I need you in my office at 7:30 in the morning. I'm going to be a man on a mission. I'm going to be straight there. I'm not going to be deterred by distractions. So that makes this a really interesting bit of scripture, I think, doesn't it? Jesus isn't summoned, but Jairus comes to him. Notice that Jairus has a name, and we know who he is. He was one of the leaders in the synagogue. So if you stop and think about that, the synagogue was the center of social and civic life for the Jews of that time. If you're one of the leaders in the synagogue, you're one of the leaders in the community. You're one of the civic leaders. And so Jairus was well known. He was probably powerful. Undoubtedly, he was reasonably wealthy. And he comes to Jesus. He falls at his feet. He says, this is a matter of life and death. My daughter is going to die unless you come and touch her and heal her. And Jesus agrees. And so we see this scene. Jesus is headed to the home of Jairus, and people are all around. His people, Jairus' people, people are following. I'm sure there were onlookers who just wanted to see a miracle take place, right? And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, he feels power come from his body. Jairus, who is named and known and powerful, we compare that to this anonymous woman. And we've talked often about the low status of women in that particular culture. A woman who has no name, who is anonymous, crawls through the crowd and touches the hem of Jesus' garment and thereby is healed. So what we understand when we look at this text was the power not only of Jesus to heal, but the power of his enormous sensitivity and his empathy for other people. The average person would have never experienced anything different. They would have been headed straight to the home of Jairus. Jesus says, "Who touched me?" He stops and turns and calls this woman out, a nobody, but a nobody who had been healed because of her faith. What this text tells us or raises for us is what it means to care about somebody that you do not know and perhaps do not see. We understand why Jesus could relate to and respond to the request on the part of Jairus, but here's a woman that Jesus did not know and did not see, and yet in this moment, on this occasion, this point of her need, she becomes the most important person in his orbit. It's a remarkable story, I think. And it raises for us the question in our society, in your life and in mine, what does it mean to care for people that we do not know and do not see? There's a woman named Sherry Turkle who is a professor, she's a PhD of social science at MIT. And she has spent a couple of decades now studying the effect of technology on our lives. We're talking about the effect of technology on what I call our human flourishing. What is it doing to us, both good and bad? And I always feel a little bit apologetic when I get onto this because, look, I carry a phone. I want people to carry a phone. I don't have anything against technology. But we also need to be heads up about what is happening to us. So she's done a lot of research and written a number of books on this. One of her primary concerns has been the effect of technology on our children and our teenagers. And look, our sixth graders, seventh graders, most of them carry phones. Some third, fourth, and fifth graders maybe carry phones. I'm not opposed to that. There are good reasons for carrying phones. But her research has addressed what happens to children when they communicate primarily through digital devices, their phones, their iPads, their computers. And she is especially interested in the development of empathy, human empathy, how it is we develop empathy for other people. And her concern, backed up by tons of research, is that our children and our teenagers are not learning empathy. And it's pretty simple if you stop and think about it. If a teenager picks up a phone and texts a mean message to another teenager on the other side of the city or the other side of the world or on the other side of the room, as they often do, if they text a mean message and they're just looking at their phone, they cannot hear the tone in someone's voice who has received that message. They cannot see the glistening, the tears in somebody's eyes. They cannot see the expression in their face. Her concern about our culture, our society, our quest for human flourishing is that we are raising generations who do not understand what empathy is for other people. But I'll just say this. I take the research that she's done. I think it's important and powerful. And what is the difference between what's happening to our children and our teenagers and what's happening to us? I mean, you pay attention, don't you? All you have to do is turn on the news. Half of the news these days is just reporting to us what somebody else's tweet is. And so it doesn't make any difference whether it's a professional athlete or a professional musician or an actor or a senator or a congressperson or the president. We're getting these tweets, this form of digital communication, and the vitriol and the meanness in our society is going sky high. What does that mean for human flourishing? In terms of what it means to be a neighbor, what about our neighborhoods, our churches, our schools, our PTAs? How is it that we are nurturing one another and teaching one another the art of empathy, how to take care of one another, what it means to be a neighbor? These are statistics that I've shared with you before, so this is somewhat redundant, but it's important enough for us to hear it again. In 2018, 45,000 Americans committed suicide. You've probably seen this research, and you know that the trajectory of that is going up. I think it's the highest of any civilized nation. 45,000 people committed suicide. We don't have the numbers for 2018 yet, but we have the numbers for 2017. Over 70,000 Americans died due to drug overdose in 2017. It'll probably be higher once we have the numbers for 2018. What does that say about us as human beings, about the culture that we're developing, about the lack of empathy, about the fraying of our networks, our social networks that help people to know that they belong, that they are treasured, that they are the children of God? I don't know, maybe those are just statistics for you. So let me tell you about this. Saturday, a week ago, we had two funerals in this service, in this sanctuary. We had one in the morning, one in the afternoon. The funeral in the morning was for a 30-year-old man who died of a drug overdose. The funeral in the afternoon was for a 30-year-old former Marine who killed himself. Now that comes home, doesn't it? Here in our sanctuary. What do we say as a church about a culture where people are feeling so lost and so isolated that nobody knows them by name and nobody cares? If this doesn't make you weep, it should. It should. One of the advantages of being 70 years old, I've been counting the disadvantages here lately. There are a lot of disadvantages. But one of the advantages of being 70 years old is that you kind of have a long view. I remember the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. And so what I'm going to say to you is just my opinion, but I feel pretty strongly about it. And I'm a little bit, I'm interested in history, so I can go back before then. Our country isn't just, we're not just rolling off the rails, we're about to fall off the cliff. When I look at the state of civil dialogue, civil conversation in our country, it is disturbing. When I see how much vitriol there is in our country, even amongst family members and friends, it is disturbing. There are so many families now where if you disagree with a member of your family, they're no longer a conversation partner. They become a part of the other tribe. They become an enemy. And this is taking place throughout our country, and it is going to run us off the cliff unless we rediscover what it means to be neighbors with one another, unless we rediscover what it means to be respectful of one another, unless we build the kinds of civic structures that care about the one we do not know and do not see. So specifically, let me just say this. We need more leadership from our leaders, from those that we elect. We need more leadership. From our legislators in Austin. You know me, I'm going to be as nonpartisan about this as you can get. I don't care whether they're Democrats or Republicans. I don't care whether it's men or women. I don't care whether they represent a suburban or an urban district or a rural district. The tone and tenor of the political discourse in Austin should be better and more noble. The same is true in Congress. Again, I don't care if it's a Democrat or Republican. I don't care if it's a member of the Tea Party or if it's a Muslim woman from New York. I, for one, think that we as people should demand an end to conversation that is vitriolic. When it comes to our senators, Republican, Democrats, independents, we had a couple of independents in the Senate. We need our leaders to stand up and say, we can do better. We are better than this. We can be neighbors and friends, and still we can be on opposite sides of the aisle and still disagree. I'm not going to leave anybody out. We need better than this from our president. My president, your president, our president. It doesn't make any difference whether you voted for him or didn't. We all need more leadership from our president on this issue. The person who sets the tone for our discourse as Americans, as neighbors, as family members. We need better. Who wants to be president of a country where a small city of over 100,000 take their lives every year because they are so miserable? I'm not going to leave anybody out, so I'm not going to leave you out or me. We need more leadership from the people in the pews. Isn't that what Jesus said to us, that we are the salt, we are the leaven and the bread, that we are the ones who should be transforming the world because we've been transformed by the love of Christ? We need more leadership from people in the pews, and our leadership may be the most important. As we transform lives through the mission of the church and with our participation in PTAs and all sorts of organizations, as we try to reweave the social net that brings us together as Americans, how we do it and how we converse with one another and in our families and, by, for goodness sakes, in the church, we need to provide more leadership about what it means to be a neighbor. After the first service, I asked Stephanie, she'll always tell me the truth. I said, you know, I was a little hot in there, Stephanie, did I run off the rails? She said, no, but you've always taught me that there should be some good news in the sermon. And there is. When we look at this story about Jesus on his way, an important mission that is a matter of life and death, this is what we discover. This story tells us that when you decide to follow Jesus, you have to care about everybody. You have to care about the person who is rich and powerful because that person is a child of God. And you have to care about the anonymous person that you do not know and cannot see because that person is a child of God. And it's like all of these other issues that we confront. When we decide to follow Jesus, the answer to this isn't multiple choice. Either we do or we don't.